If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
The big challenge is convincing people. Honestly, it's unusual and people aren't willing to, you know, go down that road too much. We've had a lot of inquiries since it's been published pretty heavily. And, you know, people are wanting different things. Nobody's pulled the trigger on starting one, though. You know, it's such a generic concept in a way that it's easily adaptable to many materials. So, you know, when we're talking to people, some people want a concrete exterior. Fine. I mean, it really doesn't matter what you do the exterior in it. It would be great to do a series of these of all different combinations of materials and just see what each feels like.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Scott Specht, founding partner at Specht Novak Architects in Austin, Texas, who previously joined us in 2023. Scott is the founding partner of Specht Novak Architects with over 30 years of experience designing and managing institutional, commercial, and residential projects. Over the past 30 years, Specht Novak, led by founding partner Scott Specht and partner Jacob Novak, has built a reputation as a forward-thinking, award-winning modern architecture firm with a strong philosophy regarding the importance of craftsmanship, detailing, and client service. The firm's work has been featured in over 250 publications worldwide, including The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Architectural Digest, and Forbes. The project we're talking about today is the Stealth House, also in Austin, Texas. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Set along a gravel alley behind a row of traditional houses in downtown Austin, the Stealth House by Scott Specht reconsiders how architecture can negotiate privacy, density, and environmental performance within the compact footprint of an urban infill site. The building reads less like a conventional home and more like a quiet, protective shell, its restrained exterior offering no hint of the luminous environment within.
We live on it's on an alley. It's a small property on an alley, and people walk up and down that alley through this neighborhood. And I had some people come up to me and go, "You live here?" And I was like, "Yeah." And they were going, "We were wondering what this place was. We thought it was a crack house for a while because it has no windows on the exterior. So it's like a bunker. It looks a bit like a bunker." But the idea is that it's made for very dense urban areas where you really, properties are small and they're looking at another house 5 feet away or 10 feet away, depending on what the setback is. So I did find this piece of property in Austin that was an ADU lot. So you have a house in front of you, one on each side, and then it faces onto an alley with no view. And just thinking about, like, do we really want to have windows on the perimeter of this house looking at virtually nothing in any direction? So we turned it all into internal. We put a big wall around the entire buildable area of the property and carved out two courtyards in order to get the house down to the buildable area, which was 1,100 square feet allowable for an ADU. So it's 1,100 square feet condition plus two big courtyards on the interior. And The interior is all floor-to-ceiling glass looking into the courtyards, so you get way more light and views of nature than you would if you had perimeter-facing windows, and it's completely private. So we don't have blinds on most of the windows. We only have them in the bedroom for sleep, and it's just beautiful to wake up in the morning to that sunlight streaming in and seeing trees and everything else without having to worry about privacy or noise or anything else.
I think you need to change the name of it to the Breaking Bad house.
Yeah. There were a lot of names we ran through. Stealth just seemed to click a bit.
The design inspiration for the Stealth house stemmed from Scott's youth and his analysis of his own suburban home, where windows face outward toward other homes, eroding privacy and reinforcing a perspective less conducive to increasingly dense suburbia.
I grew up in the suburb, a really standard suburb outside of Tampa, Florida, and it was the same thing. It was side windows looked 10 feet away, 5-foot setbacks on each side. They just looked at other houses. And my dad, we'd always keep the blinds drawn on that side. At one point, my dad actually covered over a window with a piece of art completely, just like eliminated it from the interior. And I always thought it was kind of odd, even as a kid, that why do we look at the sides of these houses and into their other windows? So it's come from a long feeling that suburban or even inner urban single family houses just don't work. You know, the models that they go by, like a ranch house or a farmhouse, it's a house on a giant piece of land where you're looking at your land. And to transplant that as is into a dense situation just never worked. So, you know, I wasn't directly looking at them, but obviously the models are like the Roman courtyard houses or many, many cultures in the past. That was a typical house where there was no perimeter, anything except a door. And then all of the light and air and access to nature came from the internal spaces. And I think it makes a lot of sense to build a suburb like this now where everything is just looks internally would I think make a hell of a lot of sense. The big trouble is convincing people to do it and changing and convincing, you know, zoning laws to be changed in order to accommodate something like this and to make it as efficient as possible would be difficult.
The design challenges a prevailing assumption in contemporary residential architecture that openness must rely on expansive glazing and public visibility. Surprisingly, the city of Austin offered little pushback on approvals.
There was a time in Austin. Austin was undergoing this massive growth and boom, and you know, property speculation was going rampant and everything. And I always used to like to look on MLS just for the hell of it, quite honestly, just to see what's out there and what things are going for. But I became really interested in these kind of properties that are, I call them scrap land properties. There's a number of properties that back up to an interstate, let's say, and you know, those houses never sell for much. And when they do, they change hands really frequently because I think people think, oh, it's going to be fine. And then they move in and it's like, I can't stand this. So their turnover and the price was a lot lower. And so I kept tracking those. And then I noticed one day on the market, this property came about. It's an ADU lot. So somebody took, you know, a lot that was 140 feet deep and cut it in half and sold the backyard off because it did have alley access. And that's what I bought. And the reason I bought it was like, it was priced great and it was in an amazing location. It is literally two blocks from a major grocery store and it's got, you know, retail and cafes, you know, one block away and everything. So it's an awesome place to live in terms of walkability, but was not so expensive and nobody else could really figure out what to do with it. So it came at the right time and I bought it before even thinking I wanted to build a house for myself. And it was, I held onto the property for a while. It just sat there and finally, we were actually doing this project as a more conceptual project in the office just for fun. The idea of the reinterpreting a courtyard house and then realized, well, that property, if I do want to build a house for myself, now's the time and this property is perfect for it. So everything fell into place at the right time. And as for getting permitting, yeah, that was when I submitted these drawings, I assumed, knowing how the city of Austin is, it was going to get rejected multiple times and you'd have to explain the concept over and over again because, you know, there are really no perimeter windows. So the fire exiting comes from doors that go directly to the outside from each bedroom. And they're covered on the inside by a large this curtain you see behind me right there. That's one of the curtains. So one wall in each bedroom is a full curtain that has an exit door behind it, a push bar exit door. And I still thought it was weird enough that we'd get some comment back. No comments. It flew right through the city. They had nothing to say about it. They're like, go ahead, do it. So yeah, and it feels, in a way, this feels safer too. It feels like you don't have to crawl through a window if a fire happens. You just got a door straight to the outside. So yeah, it feels nice as well. Yeah, and if zoning wasn't as strict as it is, this house would be perfect to be in the middle of an industrial or warehouse zone, quite honestly, because it's so internally focused, it doesn't matter what's outside of it. So I think it could open up a lot of areas to housing. Now in Austin, we're in a little bit different situation than a lot of places because during that boom, there was housing was overbuilt like you wouldn't believe here. So, and a lot of it is still under construction and just finishing up with, apartments coming online every day and the pricing is dropping. So it'd probably be a better solution for other cities at this point.
At just 1,100 square feet, the residence is conceived as a deliberately introverted object, maximizing the entire ADU site and embracing a low-maintenance landscape.
It's visual privacy, it's acoustical privacy, because we're very close. This property didn't sell for a lot because it's very close to a major road, and the noise is constantly going out there. So, here we have complete acoustical privacy as well. So it's like once you walk in that door, you're really in an oasis separated from everything else. And, it's not in it's a part of town that has a relatively high crime rate for Austin as well. So it gives a level of safety. Like when we leave anything outside the house, it gets stolen immediately. It does. And so you just can't leave anything outside. So if you had windows here, it'd be a little scarier, I believe. And the site was only 3,500 square feet total, so small. So what we did basically was take the setbacks on each side, and then that's where the perimeter wall was. So it's really built to the maximum extents that it can be built legally. And then all the extra space just went to the interior courtyards. So, you have 3,500 square foot lot, you end up with, let's say 2,000 square feet of walled in area that you're allowed to build. And then you carve out two big courtyards, and then you have the livable space of 1,100, which was maximum allowable for an ADU in the city. So that's kind of, it was pure math that determined the square footages and the site strategy here. One thing we did, we graveled the entire site, remainder of the site. So all the side yards, backyard, what's left of, setbacks really, and the front are all gravel. And then we planted some prickly pear cactus in the front as a cluster there. It works out well. I love zero maintenance, and there's nothing that you have to maintain on this house at all in terms of that on the outside. We did make some, I know that you're probably going to ask what mistakes we made, and one of the biggest mistakes was hubris and cheapness as an architect. I didn't consult a landscape architect to do this. I figured, I can do this myself. And the species I picked for the interior of the house are pieces I loved, but honestly, they're not right for this climate. So unfortunately, the big olive tree that sort of focuses the whole house, it grew beautifully, grew like mad, and it's a gorgeous tree right now. But unfortunately, there's this disease going around called olive knot. It's a worldwide scourge at the moment, and you can't get rid of it, and it comes in rainfall. So this tree, unfortunately, was infected with that, so we don't know how long it has to go. But if it does have to be replaced, we'll put a more, locally hardy species in. May not be as beautiful, but, it'll probably serve the same purpose. So if I'd known those kind of things, I probably would never have bought an olive tree. But anyway.
Lesson learned. Talk to the experts.
Yes.
The house features a restrained, nearly opaque facade of weathering steel. The rust-colored Corten surface forms a continuous, windowless envelope, reinforcing the building's protective character while minimizing maintenance over time. This quiet exterior registers as an infrastructural element within the back alley context, concealing the complex spatial organization inside.
Everything about this, and from a for cost standpoint as well, it's all extremely traditionally done. It's wood framing, and the exterior cladding is a zip system sheathing, and then a rain screen application, and then corrugated Corten steel siding on top of that. So super simple. And that's most of the house. That's, you know, three sides of the house. That's all it is, except for the exit doors. There are two exit doors. The front of the house is a little bit more of a compositional effort, where you have, you know, a garage door that was 10 feet wide. And then there was a blank panel, and then the front door. And the front door is all steel, and it's designed to be flush with everything else. So you have this kind of composition of two doors and a panel between them. And the panel was really a conceptual idea. In our renderings, we did that panel as a number of different things. We had one idea where we would sell it as advertising space. So we had like a lawyer's ad up there. And then we did, you know, it could be graffiti, it could be artists coming in. In the end, we chose that glass tile I mentioned because it's kind of neutral and it provides, you know, a much more abstract, compositional, yeah, completed look to it. But I still think it could be a number of different things. I love the idea of using like a car wrap or bus wrap and just wrapping that. And you could change your facade out every year or so as you got bored with, you know, what was there. So that's it. And there's an overhang. There's this brow that wraps all the aperture, the two apertures in the art piece, and it's quarter inch steel. That's really just cantilevered off of the front of the house. So it provides a rain canopy as you're walking to the front door, and kind of gives a nice framing definition to where the activity is happening in that Corten steel facade. So that's it. As simple as it can be.
Wait, there's a garage?
There's a garage. Yep.
Where's that?
So if you look at the front of the house, there's the dark panel to the right side. That's the garage door. And then there's the green panel, where's the art panel, and then the front entry door is to the left. So there is a garage. So the roof, it's standard trusses for make up the roof, along with some, there was a little bit of tricky framing going on there to get the floor to ceiling glass and have it turn corners and things like that. There was nowhere to put a column. So we had to do a bunch of, you know, beam into beam connections, but it's all done out of, you know, LVLs and traditional trusses. And then the roof is really just a TPO membrane up there. And then the solar panels on top of that. So we had, and rainwater is all dumped perimeter of the building. So it's got two scuppers that dump out. And eventually we want to do a rainwater collection system from those and integrate that. There were some things that were cut due to budget at the last minute, and that's one of them. So there are plenty of upgrades to go.
The project's architectural logic becomes legible only upon entry. Within the steel perimeter, the house is structured around two interior courtyards that act as environmental and spatial anchors.
So if you come in the front door, you walk into sort of a general kitchen, dining, entry space. So it really is tucked against a pair of walls is this L-shaped kitchen with an island in the middle. And then we don't really have a dining table. We have a booth. A restaurant-style booth is built in for four people, and that kind of matches our life. We don't give big sit-down parties. We just, you know, neither one of us do that. We'll go out somewhere if we're going to do that kind of thing. We do have parties where we just, you know, you mingle and roam around a bit. So the house works fine for that, but we figure we didn't need a space. And that's one of the biggest space users in a house, is you have a giant dining table for the two times a year you're going to have huge number of guests, and it sits there unused. So we just eliminated that altogether. And the booth is really cozy. I love restaurant booths. And plus there's storage beneath and above. So working storage in wherever possible was key. So the front of the house, also opposite that, has a little guest suite. That's also, as I said, a studio for my wife. And it has a bathroom and a room with a Murphy bed in it. And then you come into the main central living space, and it has glass on both sides. One side has the larger courtyard, which is about 10 by 20, 12 by 20. And it has the olive tree and some ground cover plantings in it. And then the opposite side, there's a very narrow courtyard that holds golden goddess bamboo. And it's only about 5 feet wide, but it runs the length of the house. So the bathrooms also look into this courtyard without looking into each other. So the shower is floor to ceiling glass looking at the bamboo on one side. That's probably my favorite thing about the house, is the shower. There's glass on two sides, and you have outdoor, it's there, and light coming in. It feels like you have an outdoor shower, even though it's not. And then the very back of the house is the primary suite, and it can be closed off completely from the rest of the house with a pocket door. And it has a bathroom, a walk-in closet, and a bedroom. And that's pretty much the house. So it's two bedroom, two bath, a nice efficient walk-in closet, and then lots and lots of storage built in everywhere we can possibly fit anything.
I'm in love with that shower. Bathrooms notoriously have little or no windows. I have one small window, you know, largely because you don't want floor-to-ceiling glass when you're, you know, taking a shower and doing things. But in this model, you can have all that light and have that kind of nature peeking in.
There's no way to view in from anywhere else, but you get the nature. And, you know, that depends on clients. We've done some regular houses for other clients where we have floor-to-ceiling glass in the shower and they just don't care. They're like, if somebody really wants to go through the trouble of looking up at us through this window, fine. Let them have their little fun there. But so everybody's different about levels of privacy.
Yeah, I definitely would not be okay with that. not at all. Full height glazing dissolves the boundary between rooms and garden voids, allowing daylight, air, and vegetation to permeate the interior. Together, these planted volumes transform the small footprint into a sequence of light-filled spaces that feel both expansive and intimate.
The garage actually has access from the garage right into that courtyard. So, you know, you can't see it in the photographs, but you can access that fairly easily and do all the time. And the similar for the other one, the second bedroom has a sliding door that goes into that narrower courtyard for maintenance. So they're pretty easy to get in and maintain if you have to. And then, you know, the plant choice again was important. The ground plane in that main courtyard is just liripe, which is pretty much unkillable. And it's a ground cover, but it gives it just a nice green carpet under the tree. That's a feature. And so far has worked really well.
And the inside of the glass, where it's inside the home in the courtyard where the tree is, it looks like to me that the glass doesn't go all the way to the floor. It looks like it stops.
On the olive tree side, it goes right to the floor. And actually, the detailing there is we put steel channels that down into the slab, and so the flooring comes flush with that steel channel, so it looks like the glass goes straight into the floor. And then on the outside, we did a perimeter for the tree of river rock, this black polished river rock, which is also flush with that. And it's so it just continues inside to outside very clearly. On the side with the bamboo, we have our couch up against that wall. So there is a pony wall of sorts, but it's covered, 90% of it is covered with the couch. So it feels like you have floor-to-ceiling glass everywhere. But no, it's floor-to-ceiling. It's true floor-to-ceiling. Like the channel at the floor is mirrored by a channel at the ceiling that is recessed into the sheetrock, so the glass really does die into the sheetrock at the top and into the flooring at the bottom. And so the trying to get very minimal sight lines. A lot of people ask, well, why didn't you make the whole interior open up with sliding doors to that out exterior courtyard? Well, number one, we're in Austin, Texas, where you get maybe 3 days a year, for me at least. I'm not, some people love the heat. I'm not one of them. And I like my, you know, things at a moderate temperature year round. So we would never use those sliding glass doors. And, you know, when you start to get doors that are operable, you end up with lots of thickness in the frames. The frames are offset for the tracks that have to go in. You usually want screens as well. So it gets to be a very thick and clunky assembly in many cases, especially in a small house. So here that the whole thing was to minimize any obstruction to the sight line at all. And we did for those units that are insulated glass units, they were bought to the maximum size that's cheaply producible, 9 feet. That's what determined our ceiling height in here. And for a house this small, 9 feet is just fine. And then we silicone glaze them. And, you know, I never liked the look of the silicone glazing left as is. So we had aluminum strips that were milled to the width of that silicone joint and applied over the top of them. So it's a very clean, finished look, even though it's as minimal as it can be.
Warm wood materials, subtle wallpaper, and cleverly hidden storage spaces utilize every inch of the interior space, emphasizing color and light finishes over white sheetrock.
I'm always in favor of not sort of having sheetrock walls wherever possible and doing something to them, but it doesn't have to be anything elaborate. You know, a lot of the interior walls that are not glass in this house are cabinetry. So that kind of set the right there. They're all walnut. And so you get this nice contrast of the dark. We have lighter wood floors. And then some of the walls that were sheetrock, we got a wallpaper that is a woven wood with metallic backing. It's a very unusual kind of wallpaper that is a light tone, but it just sets it's not that bright white that can kind of kill a space to me. So pretty much every surface other than a few select ones is covered with something and some sort of material. And I think that gives it its warmth. I think far too often you have these big sheetrock boxes and people hang art on them, but you really don't know what to do with that much surface area. And it never ends up quite looking as expected, I think. So yeah, we make an effort to really think about every surface.
Sustainability is embedded in the building's quiet pragmatism. A rooftop photovoltaic array with battery backup supplies much of the home's energy needs, while a super insulated envelope and low power air conditioning system significantly reduce operational demand.
When you look at, you know, energy efficiency, it's odd how it's calculated sometimes, because you have a house that's some gigantic mansion, 40,000 square feet, and you're accredited for criteria on reducing energy consumption, but the big energy consumption is just the fact of it, the fact that you have a giant house that you maybe don't need. So I think by just reducing the square footage to the absolute minimum we could live with, your energy consumption goes down tremendously. I think not having incredibly high ceilings, that to me, you know, the ceiling height has to be proportional to the space. And a lot of people just want high ceilings without thinking about how it fits the space. So keeping to a 9-foot ceiling, it still feels, you know, it's not an oppressive 8-foot ceiling, but it also feels appropriate for the width of the rooms here. So those two things alone, also having not operable glass where it's fixed glass, you eliminate the primary source of, you know, infiltration, which is leaks and joints around operable windows. So we don't have any of that. So it's a very, very tight house. It has a passive-ish fresh air introduction system where the exhaust fans in the house, it has a duct that allows air into the house when it's being exhausted elsewhere. And it has kind of a natural heat exchanger by going through the attic space and getting tempered a bit before it comes in. So it's like we didn't have to go through a lot to do that, but it gets fresh air in, and it also keeps everything temperate without having to use too much air conditioning or heating. The solar panels obviously do a lot. We got them mainly for, you know, a few years ago here in Austin. There was a big freeze and power went out for a week in most places, and everybody is kind of panicking in that. So we do have a battery backup system for this. It's interesting. It becomes a game to watch this thing, how much energy your house is generating at any time of the day. And you really kind of can obsess on it a bit. Let's turn this light off and see what happens. It's kind of fun. But it really, the energy bills have gone down to very, very low. So it's been a great addition.
I would imagine in Austin that your bigger concern isn't heating, but more cooling.
It's more cooling.
And keeping it comfortable.
Yeah, for sure. We do have a very efficient VRF system, very small. And the one thing is that we're relying a lot on the tree to do passive shading. And that, I think that's one of the magical things about the house, is when the light comes in, it's filtered through this tree canopy. And so you get dappled light everywhere. You don't get harsh beams of light hitting anywhere. It's always filtered through plant material that keeps moving. So the house has a life to it that is always there.
The Stealth House small footprint, acoustic and visual separation from surrounding density, and potential for energy independence make it a compelling prototype for accessory dwelling units, infill housing, and challenging sites often dismissed as unbuildable.
I'd mentioned that this started out as a project in our office, a paper project, not for any client in particular. So at the time, we did a lot of different studies on how this kind of idea could be utilized. Like, you know, if you imagine an empty or abandoned store in a retail area of a small town, you know, that where it's emptied out, you could put a stealth house in there and be kind of this hidden behind a store facade. So you can really start to densify areas that you wouldn't think could handle housing necessarily. And then we started to do whole subdivisions of houses like this, like as a townhouse model, where if you're okay with sharing a wall between two of these, you know, it's not really sharing a wall, it's sharing kind of a perimeter fence, more or less. That's an architectural element, but you could do entire villages with this concept. And, you know, it could be an entirely new model for a suburban living development that's incredibly dense, but still has the feel of living in a single family house with all the the yard and light and everything else that that embodies. So I do think there could be models of this. The big challenge is convincing people. Honestly, it's unusual, and people aren't willing to, you know, go down that road too much. We've had a lot of inquiries since it's been published pretty heavily, and you know, people are wanting different things. Nobody's pulled the trigger on starting one though. You know, it's such a generic concept in a way that it's easily adaptable to many materials. So, you know, when we're talking to people, some people want a concrete exterior. Fine. I mean, it really doesn't matter what you do the exterior in it. It would be great to do a series of these of all different combinations of materials and just see what each feels like.
Along with proper stormwater management, the design and construction of the project's tight envelope required technical precision and well-executed results.
You know, one of the things that may not immediately be apparent is drainage, which is interesting in this house because you have enclosed courtyards on all sides. And so we did, you know, a perimeter drain around each courtyard, which has perforated pipes and, you know, overflow. So it's a good system that drains well. But then you have those storms that come once every 10 years or so that are just deluges. And I lived in a house, a regular house, where the rain was fall was so heavy that the water started to come up on the outside of the sliding glass doors by about 4 inches. And it was like, this was a traditional, had a backyard, but sometimes it pours so hard in Austin that you just can't drain things away fast enough. So we worked with the contractor on coming up with all kind of ingenious overflow systems to do that. So the main courtyard has these dual perimeter drains that lead to the outside. And then if it really gets bad, the entire courtyard is pitched in a way that it drains out through the garage itself. And that's sort of your emergency overflow. And the same thing happens with the smaller courtyard. So we've had a couple of those rains where it really goes overboard, but it was an interesting challenge you didn't immediately think of. When you see a big courtyard like this, you immediately think, oh, the ground, you know, plane is enough to absorb whatever hits it. It's just not true in a lot of cases. So that was an interesting challenge. Other challenges were small detailing things like, you know, having this Corten steel exterior that wraps the courtyards. You know, there was a moment where you really want to, and every architect seems to want to do this, make it seem like the exterior and the interior come together. So we didn't want to do a hard stop of that corrugated Corten on the outside. So what we did was run it on the outside, and then on the inside, you'd have a window, an insulated glass unit that would intersect that. And then on the other side, on the inside, you put rusting steel as a trim, as an interior trim. So it really does feel like the wall comes all the way through and to the inside side of the house. And so we rusted that Corten, and it's got a bit of, you know, rust scale on it and everything. And people are like, oh, you want that as an interior material? Because it does flake off occasionally. And it's like, but to me, that's fine. That's just one of the challenges, not challenges, but it's one of the interesting things about the house. It's like it really does blur the inside and outside. So we have those kind of details that work their way through where every window jam turns inside with rusting steel to make it look like the perimeter completes itself in some way throughout. So I think when you have a tiny plan like this, it gives you a chance to focus on really, really small, interesting details. One of the other ones I love to point out to people is right in the living room, we have this window wall at the bamboo courtyard that runs into a cabinetry wall. And rather than having them just slam into each other, we have a mirror that's about 6 inches wide that runs all the way from the bottom to the ceiling. And it's aligned with the windows in a way that when you're sitting there looking at it, you don't see a reflection of yourself, but you just see more of the exterior courtyard going beyond as a reflection. So it's a strange optical illusion. And it's like $75 for that piece of mirror. It does so much to break apart the interior. And I always love thinking like Paul Rudolph did a lot of that kind of stuff in his crazier houses where he would use mirror and Lexan and all kind of things to sort of explode the interior space and make it feel larger than it actually is. And I kind of love those small moments.
To realize the project's ambitions, Scott took an unconventional approach in assembling the construction team.
The interesting story here is really putting the team to build it together. As I mentioned, I'm pretty cheap about these things. So I wanted to get I wasn't going to pay the normal going rates in Austin at the moment. And I wanted to make sure it was somebody who really understood what was going on. So we had one of our employees who decided he really didn't want to sit in front of a desk all day being a typical architect, and he wanted to be a builder. And so we gave him his first, this was his first project. So I kind of knew, you know, he designed several things for us. I knew he knew the detailing systems that we use. And being first project, he really wanted to make an impression with it. So we got a lot of quality work out of that contractor that, you know, if you just put it out to bid, may not have gotten the kind of attention it needs because, you know, it looks simple, this corrugated core tent on the outside, but we have it so we have no corner trim where it turns the corners, where the corrugations naturally wrap in a circle and continue on down the sides. To get that to actually work, it requires a lot of precision because you're going on the corrugation depths and spacing and everything else and having to get it exactly to work out across that module. The same with the tile on the front. You notice there are no cut tiles on the front of the house. It's all full tiles. So to get that precision in framing and sheathing in order to have the tile go in perfectly is took a lot. So hiring somebody that I knew super well and was trying to prove themselves turned out to be a great thing. And then that extended into subcontracting as well. I have a friend who is a mill worker and was transitioning from being a welder into a mill worker and wanted to do the cabinetry for the house. So it was the same kind of deal. They wanted to do a great job, let him prove himself on the project, and was willing to do things over again just to get it to look the way, you know, to look and operate how we wanted. So I kind of liken it to an Amish barn raising. You get all your friends together and they kind of help you put the thing up. So it was a good, once you got that team in motion, it was good. It was all pretty good experience overall.
The Stealth House functions as both a residence and a prototype. And to some, the project is somewhat divisive in its interpretation.
We've been edging this direction for years with projects as doing more how to treat the interface and boundaries between public and private and everything. And so the chance to explore that here in a lot of detail was good. It's interesting people's response to certain things because you do a house like this and almost immediately, even when the first renderings were out, I got word from other architects that, well, this is unfriendly. This is, you know, you need a porch on the front of your house so you can wave to your neighbors as they walk by. And, you know, that's just the way it has to be. And it's just, it's so dependent on who's living in the house and what the neighborhood is like and everything else. It's not a, you know, there's not a necessary unfriendliness to this. I think this is actually friendlier than a standard house with the blinds drawn because the front yard is wide open. There's not a big fence or gate around it trying to prevent people coming into what's a partially private space. And the tile on the front really enhances the alley for people walking by and everything. So it's sort of, it does, it seeing the reaction to it, I think, has been the biggest learning experience. It's like a lot of people have very preconceived notions about what makes friendly or what makes for a good neighborhood or good neighbors. And to me, a lot of those ideas just don't play out in real life.
In the end, the Stealth House is less about concealment than about redefining domestic openness. By turning inward, it demonstrates how a home can remain private yet expansive, modest in size, yet rich in atmosphere, an architectural response to contemporary urban life where comfort, control, and quiet refuge are increasingly valued over a view of the street. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Scott wished the non-technical public better understood about the services and expertise that architects provide.
It's very hard to explain to people. It's the culture is not designed around explaining what architects do and how they do it and everything else. It's always a great, in a movie, you have a character who's an architect and it's always a great stand-in. It has nothing to do with the plot ever, but they're always like, it's someone who's professional and artistic and there you go. We get it so much. We get call after call, especially since the Stealth House went out. Like, people are like, I want to buy those plans. And so we have a long letter we have to write that's like, okay, you can't really just do that. We actually checked into this idea of like having a set of plans to sell. Well, as a licensed architect, you really can't do that if you expect any sort of legal protection for your work, because, you know, you really need to modify it for specific sites. You need to provide, you know, structural and foundation drawings for that. You need to check the zoning, and in certain places you have to sign and seal them. So it's very tough to sell plans. And people's expectations as to what it should cost to do that is wildly low. It just, the more calls we've gotten in, is people do not understand how much work you put in, first of all, and that you should be paid for that work. You know, lots of people think you should pay $2,000 for a set of plans for a house. We just get that kind of inquiry all day. And then even when it comes to construction costs, I think for whatever reason, it's still stuck in people's heads, these numbers from 8 or 9 years ago. In Texas, we used to say 10 years ago, let's say it was like $300-$350 a square foot for a custom modern home. You could do something that wasn't high end, but there's nowhere near that now. So, and people hear what the actual numbers are and they just, you don't get a call back if you tell them the truth about that kind of thing. So you have to kind of explain. There's a lot of education that has to be done at the beginning as to what it is. Now, you do get clients that come in and they know their way around the world and they know what things cost and they've heard. So that those are great when they come in with totally realistic expectation for what something costs. But it's hard. It's probably the hardest part of the job, quite honestly, is, you know, turning someone who's very interested in your work into an actual job after explaining to them the entire process. It's also a lot more than what people expect in terms of what you put into it, like selecting all of every component of the house, let's say. That takes time, and people don't quite understand how long that takes to put together a coherent vision and all the parts that go into it. I like the car analogy. It's like, imagine if, let's say, General Motors had to design a new car, and the first one they built is what they had to sell to you. The car industry, you get 28 prototypes to go through, and they build clay models first, then they test, you know, 50 cars out. You don't get to do that with a house. It has to be perfect right from the scratch, right from day one. So to get the drawings to a point where that can happen and get the project to that point is just a lot of work. That it is very, it's not a one-line concept you can explain to people what you do. It's just, it requires a lot of education.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Scott. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
You know, I think a lot of people go into architecture. I used to hear this a lot when I was younger, where people go into architecture because it's something you do that's going to last. You know, when everything else ephemera goes away, in some ways, times change, you still have the bones of a piece of architecture there that lasts centuries. And I think that comes from looking at Roman ruins and things like that. In reality, it's not true. I think buildings get knocked down probably more than, I think a more lasting contribution is something like film, probably, that, you know, people preserve it and it lasts. And it's tough to preserve a building for a long time, especially in market conditions change and everything else. So I honestly think it does have more to do with coming up with ideas that may have an influence on the bigger society as a whole. And they can be subtle things. And I think that's what excited me about the Stealth House. It had an idea that was a little bit different than what's out there. So I think that's the best you can hope for. You can do some beautiful buildings that may last, the imagery will last and everything, but it's really coming up with new concepts that, I guess, that's my hope, that's the bigger contribution.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.